In an unusual circumstance, this is a morning edition of Everyday Law. I'm your host, Bob Clark, and welcome. Today we have a returning guest. I would formerly have called her Judge Lynn Battaglia, but now I'll just call her Lynn. Welcome back, Lynn.
Thank you very much.
As always, any opinions that are offered on this show are not those of Howard County Community College, its faculty, staff, employees. And further, any legal advice that emanates from this show is not intended to apply to your individual legal situation. One of the things we have emphasized on Everyday Law throughout the episodes is if you have a need for legal advice, make sure that you see an attorney and provide them all of the pertinent facts so they can give you an opinion that will be useful. Judge Battaglia, Lynn Battaglia, has had a fascinating career, at least from my perspective, and I kind of like to do a brief review for those who did not listen to the show in December 2017 of your educational background, because it's a very diverse history. So first of all, where did you go to college?
I went to college at American University. I was in the School of International Service, and I majored in intelligence research and analysis.
Wow, that was forethought in that time.
Well, I then went on for my master's at American and majored in Latin American area studies, which was fascinating, but I have used really neither of those in my career. So
I bet they have helped you appreciate the situation in Venezuela presently.
Well, you know, I'd like to say so, and I will say that what it did teach me was how complicated historical references in Latin America really are. So yes.
You just got to go back to Simon Bolivar and everything's okay?
Well, you know, it's very complicated. So I learned that, and I have great respect for people who are in the diplomatic corps and have to, you know, really address what's going on in the various Latin American countries these days.
Today we are working with a very distinguished Latin American who is sitting across from me. We'll get into that at a future show, I suspect. So you got your master's in international studies with a Latin American emphasis, or did I misdescribe
it? Yes. And my country of choice was Argentina. I was fascinated by the history of Argentina, especially since it had Eva Perón as its head. And you don't oftentimes see women at the helm in various countries, as you know. So I was fascinated by Argentina.
So what did you do with this facet of your education?
Well, really, for a while, I worked at the National Security Agency, and the agency put me through school for my master's, and then I was offered an NDA Title IV fellowship, which is a National Defense Education Act Title IV fellowship, to go to Georgetown, where I worked on my PhD, but my major was American government. So I was fortunate there, and I was really interested in the interaction of the various three branches of government, which is, of course, in play today.
Really? How's that?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's I have to say, as a member of the judiciary, I'm very proud of the fact that the judiciary is finally getting its due as a co-equal branch of government with the president and Congress. I think there's a greater recognition of the importance of the judiciary today than ever before. So I was fortunate to be able to be sent to school at Georgetown to learn even more about that system. And then, right before I was to do my dissertation,
Which was on what, just out of interest?
It was going to be on, because I didn't complete that, it was going to be on third-party politics. And you'd say, third-party politics. We don't really have a third
party. John Anderson.
Right, but it's like
Ross Perot.
That's right. But where did they go? You know, so it's
Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt. But we oftentimes wonder where the parties go. And I was studying the fact that oftentimes third parties go out of existence in the United States because the two major parties assume the planks of the third party. So I was going to go up and really study about that and write my dissertation. This was at the time before we had all of those wonderful laptops and access to data. So there was a mainframe in Michigan that contained this data.
So out of interest, who compiled it and why?
Well, that was an interesting thing. I don't know really now as I look back why it was compiled, but the only place where I could access it was in Michigan. And I needed to access it through the development of a program. Well, I had been trained in Fortran and COBOL, but never to the development of a program itself. So I was debating what I should do when I determined that I was actually going to go to law school. So remember, this is a continuation of a long journey from I started on my undergraduate degree in 1963. I started law school in 1971. I graduated from law school in 1974. So
an 11-year run.
It was. And it was a good run. You know, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed going to school. But you can imagine the inevitable question was, when would I ever go to work? You know? So finally, I went to the University of Maryland Law School. And I was able to complete my studies in 1974 and went to work.
So let me digress momentarily.
Absolutely.
One of the themes that I aspire to explore on the show today is the fact that just because you're studying accounting or Egyptian or French literature, it doesn't mean that you have to have a career in any of those things.
Right.
And you are, in my view, an exemplar of somebody who pursued various things and obviously had interests and maybe specific career aspirations, but at various points in time made turns in the road. So, for example, did you have something you intended to do with your undergraduate degree, your master's degree, your doctorate, anything specifically at the time?
For my undergraduate degree, I really was going to go to something like the CIA or NSA, you know, the alphabet soups, or go into the Foreign Service. Interestingly enough, at the time that I graduated from college, I believe that the Foreign Service was not welcoming women within its ranks.
Shocked to hear that.
Yeah, so, that was a different day, I guess. But in any event, so I couldn't go into the Foreign Service and did obviously end up at NSA for about a year.
So how many women were there?
There weren't many women. But NSA, I think, at that time was really trying to cultivate a greater number of women. And I was in a program that was the management intern program. So I was being trained to manage groups of people. And I think it was a result of the commitment that the agency had to really developing more women in its ranks. Remember, NSA has a large number of people who are in the service there. So at that time, there weren't many women in the service either. So there was a dearth of women.
So why do you think they had, that seems like an unusual place to have such a commitment?
Well, I think that I'd like to think that there was a recognition that they were missing out on some of the best and brightest in the United States by not having women. And certainly they had women who were interpreters there, but they also needed people who could really analyze data. So I think that women certainly have shown themselves to be at the helm of that. So
I romanticize intelligence services, and I like to think of you parachuting into East Berlin and that sort of thing. And any of that?
No, I can honestly say that did not. I am not qualified as a parachuter. I never did any of that romantic stuff.
Okay, so perhaps that's something to pursue in your 80s.
That might be something, except that I understand that in order to be a parachuter, I have to basically roll off a truck or something like that, which is not something that makes me so excited. Parachuting itself might seem exciting, but
that sounds like
rolling
more
and dropping
like
and rolling
activity.
Is exactly, you know, not that.
So you kind of thought you would do intelligence work. Did you change your sights when you were getting your master's on what you were going to do? Were you going to be a Latin America specialist? Were you going to try and what was your plan then?
Well, you know, I don't know whether I had a plan. I knew that I was fascinated by Latin America because, you know, you mentioned a romantic past. There is a romantic past in Latin America. But there was also a real sense of subjugation. And I was intrigued by that. And so I chose Latin America largely because I was interested in it, which is also something that pervades my scholastic career, if I'm interested in something.
Is it fair to say that you followed your interests at the time?
Yes. I always believe that if I follow my interest, that the rest will follow.
The reason I mention that is many out in the audience are college students. And when you're in college, I think you think you're supposed to know where you're going to end up. And perhaps your educational career is a good example of following what you're interested in and things fall into place.
Well, you know, I am somewhat structured in the sense that when I'm working, I love structure and I love to have sort of the sense of like from 9 to 12, I'll be in a certain place or whatever. But in terms of my career, I've always followed what I wanted to do rather than what I should do, because what I should do would have led me into probably early motherhood and taking care of a family, which isn't, you know, I think it's fine for people who make that choice, but that wasn't a choice of mine. It would have been a choice that would have been made for me based upon my upbringing, you know. So in following what I wanted to do, I really found my own way.
That is great advice if you're in college.
Yeah.
Because most students that are in college think they're supposed to know what it is they're going to do the rest of their lives.
I think most sixth graders are told they should know what they want to do in their lives these days.
And I just think it's important to think about what you just said, to follow what interests you best, and you usually end up in a good place.
Well, you know, I always say to people, I turned 73 in April, and I'm still looking at what I want to do, you know, and I'm sure we'll get into that.
We will get there.
But do not at 22 think you're going to know what you want to do for the rest of your life. Because I think that that's deadly.
Even if you're 27 or 28 and you have a master's and you almost have a doctorate, it doesn't oblige you to spend the rest of your life in American government, Latin American government, or anything else.
No.
To my three nieces in college, please listen to this show.
So, what made you turn in the road from getting a PhD? And I mean, were you going to be a professorial type?
Or yes.
Were you, okay. That was sort of my aspiration.
I love teaching and have taught since that time at the University of Baltimore and the University of Maryland Law Schools, off and on throughout my career. I really crave the interaction that a classroom can give me. And so I was aware of that early, and my fellowship responsibilities included teaching at Georgetown in various classes, as well as the proverbial grading and all of that, which is hateful. But in any event, the teaching itself was something that I wanted to cultivate.
So you got the opportunity to do so, and then you made a turn in the road to go to law school.
Yes.
What prompted that?
Well, that was because of the fact that at that time, in order to do the dissertation that I wanted to do, I would have had to live in Michigan. And there's nothing wrong with Michigan out there, but
all the Michiganders are calling in.
You know, remember, I came from Buffalo, New York.
The lines are lighting up, Bob, from Michigan.
Right. I came from Buffalo, New York, where the snows may be higher than in Michigan.
I think
but
you're right.
I really did not want to spend a year of my life at that point in Michigan doing the research. And that prompted me to look inward and say, what is it that I'm interested in at this point? Just to go back, interestingly enough, in my high school yearbook, I had said I wanted to be a lawyer. And so that was, being a lawyer was somewhat there the whole time. I just feel like I sort of did a frolic and detour by working on my doctorate.
It had a latency there.
And that's a legal term of art, ladies
yeah,
and gentlemen.
Yeah, right, latency, right.
So you took the turn, you went to law school. Did you have a notion of what you were going to do with that when you entered?
No, I did not. I knew that law was, as I said, a notion that I had in high school that I wanted to do. And the reason that I wanted to become a lawyer in high school was because when I looked around at my small town and saw the people who ran the town, you know, the aldermen and the mayor and all of that. They were all men, okay? And I said, that doesn't seem to be an invitation to me. And then I found out that they were all lawyers. And I realized when I was in high school that law could provide me, as well as other people, including women, the opportunity to be leaders, whether it was in politics or in whatever. And that's why I entertained the idea of becoming a lawyer in high school. So I knew that the law would afford me various opportunities that I couldn't get really by getting my PhD. So that's one of the reasons why I went to law school.
So you went to law school and you ultimately, as we have chronicled previously, went to work for Semmes Bowen and Semmes, which
yes.
was in the remains, I think, predominantly an insurance defense firm. And then you moved from there to the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Yes, I became an assistant United States attorney and I tried cases. There weren't a lot of women at that time who were trying cases, but the U.S. Attorney's Office was really the platform for women to try cases on behalf of the United States in the criminal area. You know, when I did bank robberies, I did white collar crime, bank robbery, basically anything that you can think of, I would prosecute. I also litigated on the civil area, basically because the United States has litigators all over protecting its interests. So that's what I did.
Did you find at that time that being a woman was in any way advantageous?
Yes.
Okay. How was that?
Because juries had a tendency to, I believe, trust women litigators more so than they trusted male litigators. And so I felt like I came to the courtroom with a benefit in terms of perception of my trustworthiness, which is exceedingly important if you're a prosecutor.
So many more women have come into the law as trial lawyers across the last 30 or 40 years. Do you think this preconceived notion that women are more trustworthy as trial lawyers has changed or dissipated, or how do you think it is?
I don't know the answer to that, and I haven't seen any studies about that. I think in all probability that with the number of women increasing, it may not be as obvious in terms of trustworthiness
sure.
now.
Do you think your supervisors at the U.S. Attorney's Office appreciated this phenomenon at the time?
I was curious of that as well.
Well, the interesting thing is that I think that the supervisors at the U.S. Attorney's Office were trying to understand the dynamic in and of itself of having a female in the courtroom. So
were you the only one at the time?
No, there were a number of us.
Okay.
But, you know, there must have been six women at that time at the U.S. Attorney's Office out of over 30 assistant United States attorneys. But the phenomenon of having a woman in the courtroom was still so new that just trying to figure out whether there were training needs that were different. So it was, I think, challenging for people who had never worked with women in that capacity, because litigation is a very different animal than many of the other areas of the law. You know, you really need, it's so multifaceted that you have to be aware of yourself in your presentation at all times.
Did you perceive or do you perceive that male attorneys would treat you in somewhat different manner in a litigation in that era?
At that time, many of the people who were on the other side would minimize the impact of having a woman on the other side. And there were agents who at first did not, agents of the FBI,
right.
You know, again, the alphabet soup, who did not want to work with women, you know, because they had their own preconceived notions of women. And I'd like to think that the advent of women at the U.S. Attorney's Office and the fact that the U.S. Attorney at the time, Timmy Baker, Russell T. Baker, who came from Columbia, he was a staunch supporter of all the women in the office as well as the men, and he would not allow an agent to choose an assistant United States attorney based on gender. So all of us knew that bias would go by the by because the agent couldn't choose an assistant by gender. So I think that changed as more and more women showed that they could be not only competent as litigators, but really great as litigators.
How about judges? Did judges treat you differently to your perception than they treated men in the courtroom?
Sure. Yes. I remember I did some litigation when I was at SEMS, and I went over to either the Workers' Comp Commission or one of the commissions, and I was pregnant at the time, and the commissioner told me to sit down because he didn't want a pregnant woman to be standing. At that point, I was happy to sit down just because I was happy to sit down.
Sure.
But I kept saying to him, I don't need to sit down. You know, maybe people, that was at the beginning of the time that pregnancy was considered a disability. And so he was, I don't know whether it was his personal bias because of his background or sort of the notion of disability, but he was very concerned that I was not going to be able to.
Sounds well-intentioned.
And to put this in perspective, a lot of the audience didn't live through a time period where men and women were treated that differently.
Right.
But the movie 12 Angry Men,
right,
they were all men, the jurors.
Right.
In fact, I don't believe women were allowed on the juries until the 60s or 70s.
Well, I think it was the 60s. Yeah, and that's true.
And that's shocking to think about today. I interned for Roz Bell on the Circuit Court for Montgomery County before she was appointed to the appellate court. And she told me that when she graduated from law school, the only job she could get was a legal secretary, that no one would hire her as an attorney. And I think that would be shocking for many people to hear today. But that's the way it was 50 years ago.
When I was fortunate, I've been fortunate to edit a book called Finding Justice, A History of Women Lawyers in Maryland. And women were not admitted to the bar in Maryland until 1902 and were not allowed to join the Maryland State Bar Association until 1946, which is, interestingly enough, the year that I was born. So
destined.
I know, right? I don't know whether my mother or father would have ever said that, but in any event, it is in my lifetime, I can relate stories about that. But what's so interesting to me today is that people don't know about it and sometimes don't appreciate the fact that this was really hard fought and could be lost again. I mean, it's not that women are going to be not admitted to the bar, but women don't have to be hired. I mean, in the sense that there's lots of reasons. I mean, we're already, for a number of women, they're not being in large firms necessarily made partners still. And that has a lot of reasons, some of which relate to their being mothers. But a lot still relates to the glass ceiling and the issue that women can't be rainmakers. Basically, they can't cultivate the business in a law firm.
Because the businesses are run by men?
Because the businesses are. I mean, it's all a concept. I remember it's a concept of women not being in the boardroom. I remember when I was working at SEMS and you know, there were Lever Brothers, and SEMS represented Lever Brothers. Lever Brothers really wanted to have a woman on its litigation team because it recognized that some of the jurors would be women, and that having a woman on the team would portray Lever Brothers in a better light than just having all males on a team.
All white men.
All white men. Privileged white men. And I look at myself as a privileged white woman now. So, it's interesting because it all comes down to some level of economics, to corporate culture, and the fact that women need to have board seats. They need to have a place at the table in order to really move society more to accept women as equals.
Just to let some of the younger members of the audience know, it wasn't until the 1970s that the Johns Hopkins Club admitted women to the restaurant. And I just recently learned this. So that is a place where there's going to be a lot of professional advancement. You're going to have meetings there. Right. You're going to meet people there. And to exclude 50% of our population from meetings there astounded me. But I just want the audience to know this was fairly recent. This was within the last 40 to 50 years that women were treated as second-class citizens.
Well, that's true in many of the clubs downtown, too.
Still?
Because not so much still, but when I was at SEMS, because I was on the recruiting committee at SEMS, and at one of the clubs downtown, we had to eat on the third floor because they only allowed women on the third floor for lunch. Well, men could go. It sounds so ridiculous now. I asked the partners rather than doing that because that really made me feel ridiculous having to go to the third floor.
It is astounding to hear.
You know, so
I regret to say I have to steer this little discourse to the last 3 minutes of our show, wherein we note that you take a turn in the road from being U.S. attorney going to the highest court of the state of Maryland.
Right.
Is that something you had ever anticipated doing in your pre-lawyer years, in your lawyer years, at any point in time?
No.
Okay.
No, I was not a person who said in law school, I'm going to be a judge. I've met people who say that.
Sure, sure.
No, I never said that.
So how'd that happen?
Well, I was at the right place at the right time. I was U.S. attorney from 1993 to 2001. And then at that point, an opening came up on the highest court, the Court of Appeals. And interestingly enough, I was the first one to hold the seat on the Court of Appeals from Western Maryland, which includes Howard County. For those of you who are listening to this or will listen to this from, Western Maryland in terms of Oakland and Allegheny County and all of that, and Washington County,
Cumberland.
Yes, Howard County is a part of Western Maryland for the seat that represents Western Maryland. So
you are fating yourself to a return because we can't possibly cover the latest aspect of your career. But I will briefly synopsize and let you give a little comment as a teaser for future shows.
Okay.
That there is a mandatory retirement age for judges of 70 in Maryland. And
yes.
You observed this. You didn't try and stay in the White House. Oh, excuse me, the Court of Appeals.
No.
An extra time.
No.
And what did you choose to do then and why?
Okay. I retired in April of 2016 when I turned 70. And I stayed on to complete my work and all of that. And then in August of 2016, I started my Master of Science degree in Clinical Mental Health Systems, Clinical Mental Health Counseling at Hopkins. And I did that because I had a deep desire and I really wanted to do it. So, you know, when you can tell I try to do what I want to do. And I saw it as an opportunity.
Life philosophy there, audience, life philosophy.
Right. And so I felt that mandatory retirement is hard. And I've just done a study of that, as a matter of fact. But I thought it was that you have to turn it into an opportunity. And it was an opportunity for me to do something that I've always wanted to do. And so I graduated 2 weeks ago, tomorrow. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you, thank you. And I'm very pleased about that. Now I'm taking the summer to catch up on things that I haven't been able to do. The Pikachu movie. I took my grandchildren to do that. I only see animated movies. But in any event. And getting my life together and looking at what I want to do next.
That sounds like that's the next show. This has been Everyday Law with your host, Bob Clark, and our guest, Lynn Battaglia. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, I'm honored. Thank you.
Farewell.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.